be professional.
We're going to be very professional, and I think the first indication of why you are so in demand is that you showed up for our podcast at exactly on time, stroke of 9 o'clock, and I always thought that I think that's a great asset, which is showing up on time. Is that something that you've always done?
Oh, I'm sure it's not something I've always done, but as an adult, anyway, I'm pretty good about it. Yes, and I do feel if you don't do that, you're tacitly saying that your own time is more valuable than everyone else's, and that's pretty insulting. So I try to always show up on time.
That's really nice, and I think for all the perspiring young composers out there, it's a very, very good lesson, because all of us have experienced all varieties of that. People showing up early, which is nice, on time, and then the anywhere from 15 minutes to an hour late version, which is always kind of amazing.
I'll tell you as an example. When I go to the recording studio, I always get there early, but Joel and Ethan Cohen are always there earlier than me, pretty much. So that tells you something about it. Showing up early is, it's important. You get a sense of what's going on in a situation like that, right? You can sense if anything's wrong or any problems haven't been solved. It's valuable.
I really like that. This morning, I could have been sort of a minute before we went, but I thought, just going to jump on and sort of test stuff so that when you appear, it's together, as opposed to when you appear, I'm futzing. That being said, it's lovely to see you.
It's lovely to see you, too.
It's been a minute. I think we had a conversation about Macbeth.
That's probably right.
Probably 2 years ago. But for our audience, of course we have Carter here because he is, I think we go right to the headline here, an Academy Award nominee this year among five pretty remarkable challengers to your throne here, of which you're about to seize. If I'm not mistaken, Carter.
Great, yeah.
Yeah, it's your third nomination. They say three times the charm. So are you ready to say to John Williams, I never thought I'd be competing with you and winning? Have you thought about what you're going to say to the maestro for beating him with your unbelievable score for Banshees of Inisherin? Do you think about the fact that you're in the category with him?
That's just a bizarre coincidence. But of course, he's been nominated so many times that the odds are anyone who else is nominated will be in there with him, because he's
nice.
It just happens so often, right? It's a statistical fact. But I think it's great to be in there with Justin and Volker and the group Sunlux. These are all, this is the younger generation, I guess you would say, whether they think of themselves that way or not, and they're all doing such amazing work. I think it's very exciting to hear the direction that film scoring is going.
That is so generous of you, and I agree. And I wonder, I was truly trying to scope out the Academy's luncheon photo. And the Academy lunch was a couple days ago or yesterday. And
it was yesterday.
Yeah. Yep. Did you get a chance to talk to any of those human beings that you just mentioned? Were they there? Of course.
Yeah. I didn't see John Williams. I'm not sure if he was there. But but I saw all the others and made sure to say hi. I know Justin a bit and Volker by now, but I'd only seen the Sunlux guys on Zoom before, so it was fun to see them in real life. But that's what the luncheon is all about. It's like going up to people and saying hi, people you will never run into. I said hi to Bob Iger. When am I ever going to do that?
Oh,
I asked him
please
how he
share.
felt.
And, yeah, how did
I
you
asked him
feel?
how he felt about Banshees of Inisherin being a Disney movie, and he kind of he looked off into space. Because I think to him, I'm just like a gnat that was like flying around. Like, do I have to think about what this guy's saying to me? I don't know.
Golly, I wish you'd said he said, you know, it's funny, that scene where the donkey dies, that was one of the most, I wish he had given you some really deep response about how intimately he appreciated the film. Any other great, who did you sit with at lunch? That's always a big fun table.
It's true. I sat with David Greenbaum, one of the presidents of Searchlight Pictures,
Yep.
and Leslie Barber, who's one of the governors of the
Oh,
music
great.
branch.
Yeah.
The two songwriters from Natu Natu,
Oh, amazing.
and the other people were so far on the other side of the table. I don't honestly know. I didn't get a chance to talk to them, so I'm not sure
But it sounds
if
like a
they were.
music table, which is kind of
It's
nice.
true. Yeah.
It's very nice. Of course, I've been, not only did I see the film, but then I decided to listen carefully to the Banshee score. I know that you've been asked many times about the quality of it, but I think musically it's super interesting. I even went to the piano and parsed out the, and wish I was smart enough to know, boo doo boo doo boo doo 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 doo. I sort of thought, because I think in the key of C, I thought C, E flat, G, A flat, B flat. And I looked at it and I thought, okay, this is definitely a mode of which I don't know which one, or it's the A flat major scale played starting on a C. But whatever it does, it makes me feel kind of creepy in a way. I can't explain why, but those notes, the irony is those notes played beautifully on a celeste are still weird, are still weird. That's a combination. Is that something that the kind of yin and yang of that occurs to you as you're composing it?
Yes, and it's of course that's in the DNA of the movie. It's a both a very sad, very funny movie. Horrible things are happening, but there's also a lot of humanity and warmth. I had to. The key to all of the music really is to write something that will work with all of those possible situations, because that's the world these characters live in, and so it has to always be have some innocence, but also it has to play lost innocence as well. It has to play horror and but love. It's yeah. So it really was kind of a blender of different, tonalities, so that they were all in a sense there. And it's funny, when I talk to people who have seen the film, some of them identify the music right from the beginning as being sweet, and some of them identify it as being dark. Like right from the beginning, they hear the same piece of music but hear it completely differently. And and the same thing with the film. I talk to someone, they come out of the film and they may have one thing to say, and I talk to them a week later and they feel completely differently about it. So I think that's the strength of Martin's writing and directing and these amazing performances. So yeah, I mean that's right. It is all exactly as you
Well,
described. That is the
you're
foundation.
modest because it's also the strength of composing a score that is, I don't even know what the visual is, and I know you're visual from animation and all that. It's sort of looking at a beautiful stained glass window with the sun. Oh, isn't that sweet and beautiful? And then you look at the images in the stained glass window. I don't know why this comes to me, and they're sort of dark and a little. So I really felt that because the instruments are beautiful, a celeste and a harp, and oh, isn't that pleasant? But the actual choice of notes, the more I sat and listened and played them, I thought, man, if you played these notes on like a big cello ensemble, it would be a horror film. They're scary. So I really love that you combine that. I wondered, where did you record? At Abbey Road?
Abbey Road, yeah, Abbey Road Studio 2.
Oh my goodness. How about
Yes,
it? How
that's
about
Adobe Studio 2.
the vibrations in Studio 2? Were you upstairs looking down on the band?
No, I was
Well, you were
conducting.
conducting. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I love it's such a great room. And this is a very small ensemble. I mean, I can't
Yes.
imagine that we had more than 20 instruments at, even at its largest. And so you really could hear every single instrument. And I was able to use some instruments that, like bass flute, which you can't typically fit into an orchestral setting because it's so quiet, really. But with this small ensemble, we could they're actually able to use bass flute along with bass clarinet as my woodwind section. I love, honestly, I love these small ensembles where you can have individual conversations with every player about what they're doing. And I learn so much, and I feel like it, because everyone knows that everything they play will be heard, everyone's so on it, you know. You can't, you know, no one can relax, which I
It's really
like.
like a small ensemble for a play where every line of dialogue, instead of a big loud orchestra and a chorus on stage, and you can every note means something when it's that small. And
Well, that's,
I mean,
yeah,
I love that.
it's a nice way of putting it. No, I love that too. And it's also a function of, it's funny, I was talking to Volker Bertelmann. We had breakfast together at the hotel this morning, and talking about how, you know, when you have a movie with less than 60 minutes of music, you can really indulge your perfectionism. You really can't, I don't think you can do that if you're writing 90 minutes of score, you know. But with this is probably 40 minutes of score or something like that. Yeah, you can really just get in there and fine tune it to your heart's content, which I love to do.
I wonder about the process, just because I read that you and Martin were on different continents.
Yeah, that's
And
right.
I guess in this day and age, that's a little more okay. I used to have a rule that I learned painfully that the composer and the director should not have an ocean between them. And the way I learned it was that I was working on films in Los Angeles with the composer in the UK, and there always was a moment where the director freaked out, and this cue is all wrong, and it's the middle of the night there, and it's 8 a.m. here, or whatever it was. And it was always, I mean, I had some real moments of calling a composer, say, "You better get your ass to Heathrow right now and be at LAX tomorrow morning." Now, electronically, I mean, you said Martin and you were never, except for one day, you said, where he was in New York.
We spotted the film together, but that was it. And then I saw him at Abbey Road next time I saw him. I know what you're talking about, and I'm also aware that because I live where I live, I don't live in LA, that very philosophy you just described prevents me from working on a lot of films because I can't be in the, you know, I'm not down the street at all. But I do also agree with what you're saying about that technology has made that easier. And to be honest, the pandemic has made it easier. We're all just a lot more comfortable with you know, these technologies that allow us to see each other, talk to each other, send things back and forth. The pandemic never really did, I think, change the standard of what we expect in terms of human interaction, for better or worse.
Completely.
And it allows me to, you know, now it doesn't seem quite so odd that I live at the end of Long Island, whereas, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, it definitely did seem odd. Now they're, you know, all these people went off and to do remote work and all this, and decided, oh, I don't need to live in the city anymore. So anyway, I think for Martin and I, it's natural. We've never been in the same place when I've been writing his scores. He lives in London, I live in New York, and but we've done enough of this together that, you know, I think we understand each other. And also, I'll have to say this: he's a writer. Like when I work with Joel and Ethan Coen, they're writers, and so his emails are usually very clear, and And so there's very little misunderstanding. He can say in a sentence, he can put it in a sentence what he's after. Sometimes I'll admit with Joel and Ethan, I can't, sometimes without face to face, I can't tell when they're being ironic, if they're telling a joke
Of
or they're
course.
telling me something else. But anyway, with Martin, it's always been very clear, I think. And sometimes, like with any director, I have to nail him down. So does that mean this is okay with you? And he's juggling other things, and the cut may still be changing. So, but I have to at some point. It's true on every project. At some point, put in front of a director the list of cues. Say, okay, so are we clear on this? Are we clear on this? Is this good? Because they're doing so many other things. And no one in a way wants to commit if they could possibly put it off for another week. But yeah, that's so true in every project.
What is he listening to that you're sending him? Are you doing high quality demos with synthetic instruments until you get to the stage?
Smile because it depends on how you define high quality. I think, I mean, for a score like this, I think they were very high quality demos because, it's really like a fairly small group of instruments, and some of which in the samples were actually kept, like the Celeste, the final Celeste is my sample because I've had bad experiences renting Celeste, and they sometimes can be a little clunky or they haven't been regulated properly. Also, there are gamelan gongs in the instrumentation, which also I use samples because that way I can tune them better to the Western instruments. So this one, yeah, lent itself very well to a synth rendition. Probably if you listen to the synth rendition, you'd say, yeah, that is really good. That said, I'm not like Hans, and I don't have people out there like tweaking my synth demos. It's really just me doing them. So, saying they're high quality, it's a relative thing. These were pretty good, but they're never going to be like someone who has a guy to actually do his synth demos for him, right? What I try to do with that in regards to that is I say to the director, okay, my first demo, I'm going to really be really careful with and make it sound really good. But I'm a composer, I'm not a demo maker, and my time is better spent writing music. So please expect the later demos to sound like crap because I'm just not going to be in there like really fine-tuning everything.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever find yourself playing the budgeting game? Well, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive, you can find options that fit your budget and potentially lower your bills. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
Are there people out on the tip of Long Island that are available to you for, MIDI, SMPTE consultation with plugins? And are you really technologically isolated? I mean, I'm sure there are, but
I mean,
do you have,
right,
I'm
that's
so
right.
used to composers having a guy around them that's like, or a woman that's there not only making tea, but the tea boy or tea girl is sort of installing apps. Do you have that, or are you really solo?
No, ever since I moved out there about 13 years ago, and when I lived in the city, I had a person who would help me. But for the last 13 years, it's been solo, make my own tea and install my
Oh,
own apps.
shoot.
And I there are people out there who from time to time are out there who can do this stuff, but there isn't enough work out there to support a person with these skills. You know what I mean? I can't give them constant work, and I only need someone when, yeah, maybe once every few weeks or when something goes terribly wrong, I need someone.
Oh, God.
But no, I don't really have a person. Yeah.
So when you get to the stage and you're in the same room with Martin, I assume he comes to the score dates. Yes? Is that
Yes.
assuming too
Yeah.
much?
Oh
He
yeah.
does.
He lives in London, and we're scoring in Abbey Road. So yes, he's
And
there
does he,
every day.
are there any bombshells like, geez, this sounded good when I heard it in my headphones, but now that I'm hearing the band play it, not what I expected?
What certainly didn't have a bombshell. The only thing we had was that there was one cue where he and the editor had actually slid the score by like 2 or 3 seconds, and wanted, they felt that it landed, the ending landed where they liked, but of course by sliding at the beginning wasn't, it wasn't where I liked. So, but that was it. And they somehow that had slipped through the cracks, and they told me about it when we were recording, but we still had another day of recording. So, actually went back to the hotel, and I was able to keep the ink, as they say, and really just like change the timing a little so that the beginning was working for me and the ending was working for them.
You didn't at that moment put your head down and say, I'm devastated. That was my favorite. I've seen it. I've seen a composer say that was my favorite moment, and I need to step away for a moment. I'll give me some time. Did you throw a hissy? Right, exactly.
I know. It's an interesting one because it's a scene where, have you seen the film?
I have.
Okay. So it's a scene where, Colin Farrell's sister, Siobhan, is leaving the island on a boat.
Oh, and, that's an amazing scene.
Carrie Condon. Yeah. It's probably the most emotional.
She's so wonderful. Yep.
She's so wonderful. And, nothing is said. It's a long scene, which is all music really. And, she's leaving, and it's the biggest event in his life really at that moment, and hers as well. So the music's playing that, and then at the very end you cut up to him on the cliffs looking at her, and you sort of see a figure out of focus in the distance, and you know, it's a dark figure and definitely a little bit foreboding. And the question was, how do we play that, the dark figure, like And Martin really wanted it to be quiet, but when we tried going quiet for the reveal of the dark figure, it seemed like we was making too much of it. And so it was really very much of a filmmaking decision. Like, where do we end? You could also, I wrote a piece where it went on for another like 6 seconds and took him home. And that really made the dark figure not important by just playing through it. But then that, it made it too not important. So he and Martin and the editor were just trying all this trial and error that I wasn't part of moving it. And do we end it here? Do we end it there? I mean, they came to their own conclusion about what ending they wanted. And then they had worked on it so much, I couldn't, there's no point in my arguing it. It's fine. It's better that they had a decision, right, than not have one.
Right.
I just had to make the whole rest of it work with the ending that they wanted.
And so this happened in the room, the band plays
in the room,
the cue, and they say, great,
oh, we forgot
except...
to tell you.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
How do you feel it worked finally?
Oh, I think it works. It works well. Of course, for the sake of argument, I could say I could have worked the other way too, but there are a lot, it's a subtle movie, and full of scenes that you can interpret in different ways. And for instance, that figure, which I think we all assume is Mrs. McCormick, the old kind of the closest thing we have to an actual banshee in the film, right?
Right, exactly.
But what is she? Does she see? Is she just a creepy old woman, or does she actually see, death coming to the island, or does she cause deaths on the island? We don't really know. And I think the not knowing is what you want to achieve. And I think they did achieve that. The music just doesn't tell you one way or the other about who she is.
What's remarkable is, as a viewer of the film, of course, the audience is completely unaware of this decision-making that goes on that subtly shapes. So we all arrive at our own conclusion, slightly directed by the picture and music, but kind of wrapped up in trying to understand where we are and what's happening on screen. And it's always wonderful to learn how much went into that moment and why that's so. The director had a point of view that he wanted you to score a certain way. It's funny that you say, he's such a great writer, because I understand, of course, what a value that is, but music and words are very different. So if he says, I want it more sad, are you going back and forth? What kind of sad? Melancholy sad or tragic sad? The composer has such a huge responsibility to translate words from a director.
Right.
Is he the greatest writer that he directs you in a way that you say, totally got it. I got it.
Well, it's, you know, I feel that it's not that unlike being an actor, like my job, that, and the director has to find the way to get you to the performance, right? The same way with the actors. And you know, hopefully it's not by singing the notes to you. Most actors don't like that when there's like the director feeds them their lines. And same for me. But in this case, the case of this film, almost all Martin's directions were in the form of, or were kind of like negative instructions. It was, let's not end this so sad. Let's not, we can't let it land too happy or too, for the entire length of the film, basically, the music can be neither too much this or too much that, because the audience's ability to insert themselves into that ambiguity is what makes a movie like this. I think that they can be with feeling for one character or feeling for the other character, or thinking everybody on this film is crazy. It's, and you don't want to push them. And that's, I think whatever it is people enjoy about this film, I think it is that, that they are put in this position of having to say, well, he's got a point. Yeah. Well, I don't know what she's got a point, you know, they, all of the characters are very, I mean, despite very heightened things going on, they're all at the same, are real characters with real motivations. And you just don't want to, I tried very hard to avoid coloring it. And what I ended up doing, my solution to that was to sort of have the music, like if here's where all the action and, you know, the characters are living, the music kind of goes up and lives up here where it's more like floating above the action. It never plays any human's actual emotion. Like even the scene I was describing where Siobhan is leaving the island, probably the most emotional scene in the movie, is just Celeste and harp. And finally at the end, in the big part, a flute and a clarinet come in, right? It's so restrained that what I found, and Martin and I both found, was that the less that I said, all that restraint made the situations even more emotionally painful for you. You know, the music isn't holding your hand. It isn't saying, oh yeah, this is so terrible. Let's all cry now. It never says that. It's, and in the end, I think when I look at it, I think what the music does is makes the whole story more like a fable, so that you don't really think a guy has really cut off his fingers. I mean, he never even puts bandages on them. It's not like a real, these are not physical realities. And these are not, as specific as the film is about time and place, and costume and, you know, setting the sets. I tried to play it more like it's a fable, like an allegory. And that's just the music. That's not true, I think, of the characters necessarily. They're all very grounded and have very specific motivations, but the music does a different thing, operates at a different level, allows the audience to maybe step back sometimes from these things and not get too bogged down in the individual complaints and bickering that the characters might be involved in.
I think you're articulating. Go ahead.
Well, no, but I'm just going to say, I didn't really figure out that that's what I was doing until I was about halfway through the film. But I saw what was working. And it was actually, was the way that it came to me was that I was reading Grimm's Fairy Tales to my daughter. I was reading.
Oh, I love this.
I was reading Cinderella to her. And we get to the part where the evil stepmother has her own daughters cut off parts of their feet to fit into the slipper. And I was reading, I was about halfway through the score at this point, and I thought, oh, this reminds me of something. And I realized that in a way what I was working on, or the way I was interpreting Martin's film, was as a fable. And that it seemed to, it just was working. But I couldn't have said why before that. But then that experience allowed me to say, oh, I see, I'm making a sort of a fable out of it. And I think that is very helpful to the audience in terms of their way they interpret what they're seeing.
I love that, because actually, now that I think about it, It is a magical world. Inis Sharon doesn't, you know, everybody's kind of going to Google Maps to say, where is it?
Yeah, it doesn't, I want to go there. It doesn't exist.
Right.
That's right.
And you've just kind of articulated the fact that all of it is a little fate. I would say the Fablemans, but that's really kind of going too far. But it is, And though, first of all, when you win and you're giving your acceptance speech, I hope you thank your daughter for that moment of Cinderella and Grimm's. But I think it's you've just articulated it might be a longer conversation for another day, but I became aware over the several decades that I've been working in film music that what you just described of kind of dialing back, you know, you said you visually did it over the action as opposed to holding your hand, has become far more of a style of film composing. And so this is actually so accurately appropriate for the film, but I saw directors more and more, I don't want any music, first they'd say, because I don't want the audience to be directed as, you know, so, well, we could try that, but you're probably going to need music. It often was on the most emotional films, they'd say, I just don't want the audience directed. And so a lot of scores, I felt, it's funny, you said this with your hands, I felt composers have moved further and further to the back row. They're scoring from the very back row of the bleachers. I don't know if you've noticed that as a trend, whether that's just your style and they caught up to you, which is in a way your approach has been, you know, I'm not going to direct the audience or hold their hand, but so many composers have moved towards that. Do you feel it?
I love that. And I do feel it. I think I know what you're talking about. And I do feel it. That's certainly, I mean, I think it is a trend, you know, that area, that era that is so often called the golden era of film scoring. To me, it wasn't a golden era because those scores just said way too much. It actually inhibits my enjoyment of those films. I can love the scores, absolutely. You know, a good Corn Gold score or, you know, Max Steiner, they're fantastic. But that does, you know, kind of, it's there with you every second of the film and telling you how to feel. And I just am not that, as a film viewer, that's not what I like. And so as a composer, I try to avoid that. And I do think that there has been a trend in that direction. I'll say one thing, one response to what you were saying. I think, for instance, Volker Bertelmann, who I was just having breakfast with, you know, his score to All Quiet on the Western Front, it doesn't play the characters. It doesn't necessarily even play the moment by moment thing that's going on, but it's also definitely not in the back row. It's right, it's on top of you, you know, when it's there. And that's interesting. It really is. I feel like the same with Banshees, that it is, it's a really present voice, but just, you know, coloring the world that you're in rather than telling you about story or character, plot, or emotion even. It's really just creating a world.
Really interesting that you've just identified. In some ways, it's almost like these two trends are starting to come together, where it's not emotionally directing you and it's not emotionally ambiguous. It's just oddly in your face of a whole new character and saying music could be that too. I mean, there's some moments in that one where, you know, the snare drum is slammed and you think, oh, what? But it's cool.
I know. It definitely did to me. The first snare drum hit was like, I was also, what? I rewound it. Was that really a snare drum that I just heard? Because you have to wait like 5 seconds for the next one.
Oh, I know. That's so odd. There's space. I think also what we're talking about is that the filmmaking has changed too. From when you say
That's right.
Korngold or Steiner, you know, those were good guys and bad guys, and here comes the cavalry. They're in love and it's swelling up, and I'm going to make you feel that way. Obviously, as this 20th century evolved and there was ambiguity about who was good and who was bad, and filmmaking became anti-heroes and all that stuff, which we could go off on a tangent. I think music slowly started to say, I'm not going to decide who's good and who's bad. I'm just guessing. I'm making this up on the fly. So, but that maybe film music changed as films changed and directors didn't want to tell the audience, is this guy good or bad? Carter, before I
Yeah, I think that's
let
right.
is it, you know, it just feels like in
No.
a lot of the pictures you've worked on, is that a good guy or a bad guy? Is in any of your incredible scores, Fargo and Barton Fink and, you know, are some of the Big Lebowski, are these characters are complicated. They're not good or bad in some ways. They're just human. And so the composer can't put a stake in the ground. That's a good guy. He's a complicated guy. He does weird things, but you kind of love him. So it's a challenge for the composer. I wanted to just ask, what's next? Do you know, or do you just, you said in one, I think in our last interview a year or so ago, you said, I'm still trying to find my career. And I thought, after 90 films, I have a sense of what you may do for a day job, but it might still be ahead of you. But are you working on anything you can share with the massive audience that's tuning in?
Yes, I am. You may recall that the then we last we spoke, I think it was about Joel Cohen's Macbeth. I think you guys had asked me if Ethan Cohen was going to, make films, or if they were going to make films again together, and I said, well, Ethan doesn't want to make films anymore, and then because he and I had spoken about it, but I didn't realize he had never actually publicly made a declaration like that. So the very next day, the trades picked up my quote from your podcast, and it was like, Ethan Cohen says he doesn't want to make films anymore. Anyway, I had to apologize to Ethan
Amazing.
for that. And he said he put me in charge of all his subsequent press releases.
Oh yeah, good.
But yeah. So anyway, I'm not at liberty to say I'm working on Ethan's next movie.
Remarkable.
He shot a film in the fall, and I'm just starting to work on it now.
That's so great. And when would we see this or hear this? Any idea?
It'd be this year, but I don't know
Okay.
anything about release dates. But sometime this year.
That's exciting. And Todd, anything coming up? There's really three. I think of you attached to Todd, Martin, one or both Cohens. And or other compose other directors knocking on your door, I'm sure always.
Yeah, there's always things around. Of course, I'm going to find my next career. I have to start saying no to this one. Last year, I did a film with Lena Dunham, Catherine Called
Yes.
Gertie, is the
Yep.
title, and so I'd never worked with her before, and we talked
Nice.
about it for some years,
Yep.
and that was nice. So I don't know what else is up after Ethan's movie. I think I owe Apple one more season of The Morning Show. Well, I do. I
Yeah.
know that I owe them one. So that'll be
Yep.
happening.
Yep.
But I wouldn't mind some time off.
I understand. It's a really interesting moment in so many artists' career where they get exactly what they were hoping for, and then they get to the moment where they think, I'd like to take a minute. And I have seen it with composers, be successfully achieved. I'm taking time off, and I really am. And one of my great friends was in the UK on his year of Don't Call Me, and a big, big director reached through the many layers of Don't Call Me and said, I need you back in LA to write, to fix my film if the current composer isn't doing the job I need. And he protested, and the director said, I won't hear this. Be here tomorrow. And it was total fail. He came back to LA and sort of his whole year collapsed. So I say that as a cautionary tale. If you're going to take time off, cancel your email address.
I took 2 years off after my second child was born because I was aware that I could, I wasn't doing a good job of being a parent and a composer. You know, it's hard for anyone, I think, to do both.
Yep.
And I was just painfully aware of that. So I just stopped for a couple of years so I could be with my two sons when they were little and have that time.
Nice.
But I did underestimate how difficult it would be to get back into things because, if you stop working for two years, people, the executive suites change. People don't know who you are. What was the last thing he did? Honestly, if it weren't for the Coens, who, of course, did keep working, it would have been, I'd say, hard to get back into it. I'm aware of that.
It's confusing, but I think also at this point, I'm going to go way out on a limb saying you could go away for 2 years, and on the first day back, there'd be a line of people saying, is he back?
I don't know.
I am convinced. There's no question. But I think it's a funny bit for all of us. And all I can hope is that you get exactly what you would want at this point because you've earned it. And
well, I feel
you have, and so
I feel that way. Yeah. I'm at an age where a normal person would just, if I were a plumber, I would probably be thinking about retiring. But, I enjoy my job. I'm aware. I know a lot of working class people, and it's a different thing. I actually like going to work every day, and it's not looking forward to retirement particularly. I just like more space to be able to do other things. That's all.
I think that we just have gotten, in closing, our press headline that's sensational out of this podcast, and it is Carter Burwell considers plumbing career. And I think that there's going to be now your plumber, instead of Ethan calling you, your plumber's going to call you and say, dude, what? I don't do a good enough job. You're going to do it yourself?
Oh, yeah, right.
I'm upset. Anyhow, Carter, always a pleasure. Always a pleasure to see you. And, so excited about this movie, so amazed by the quality of your work in all of them. But this one kind of blew my mind, as I said at the beginning, because it was beautiful, beautiful, wonderful instruments playing really challenging melodies. And I thought, this is a step forward. My best to you. Travel safely if you're going back to the East Coast soon, and thanks for joining me this morning. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. It was good to catch up.
We'll see you soon.
Okay. Bye, Robert.
See you, Carter.